Good morning. Please be seated. State B. Young, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honor. Please, the court and counsel. My name is Scott Peterson. I'm here for the King County Prosecutor's Office. I was also the trial prosecutor below. I would also like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
All right. Proceed.
As you're probably aware from reading the briefing, this is a case involving a securities fraud perpetuated by Mr. Clarence Young. About the net amount of loss to the victims was $1.2 million. That's their investment, less whatever money he returned to them. The total could be estimated at more than $5 million based on the money that actually came into their hands. And what Mr. Young was doing is he was collecting money for feeder funds so that he could get a certain amount, $1 million in this case, to invest in hedge funds. He'd done this before with another hedge fund investment, which was investigated by the SEC and closed down, and somehow he managed to convince investors in that hedge fund and other tax clients and personal friends to invest in this new one, which he called Safeguard, and that's purpose was to gather money for an investment in Gemstar. What happened, of course, as you know, was Gemstar paid off about $5 million before the SEC intervened. Mr. Young had that money in his possession, but failed to return very much of it, if any of it, to the investors, instead electing to spend it on his winery.
We're pretty good on the facts.
All right. I won't belabor them anymore.
Cut to the error.
Pardon?
Cut to the error, please.
Yeah. The standard review, which has been stated by our state Supreme Court in a number of cases, is first we have to determine whether the reasons for the exceptional sentence that was imposed were supported by the record, and whether those reasons justify an exceptional sentence, whether they were considered by the legislature, whether the factors were substantially and compelling enough to distinguish the crime from others in the same category, whether they relate to the crime and make it more or less egregious, et cetera. Here the judge relied on several factors, and I've tried to kind of summarize them. There were many in the – I don't mean to mislead the court, but there, you can read her findings. I'm sure you've got them. But they basically boil down to his medical conditions, that the exceptional sentence was, that she imposed would save the state money, that he could make restitution if he got an electronic home detention sentence, that he made restitution payments, or at least the payments were characterized by defense as restitution payments, that he was remorseful, and he's 69, had no criminal history, and was involved in any violence, et cetera.
It seems like the Supreme Court, going back to Pascal, which is now an almost a 30-year-old case, basically says that individual characteristics of the defendant cannot be used to depart downward. And I've always wondered about that. What in the SRA itself says that?
I think they just interpreted it from, I'm assuming that it's not stated that way in the SRA.
I'm curious. So I'm just.
Well, I am too. And all I can think of is that the statutory ones that are set forth by the legislature don't allow for any personal circumstances to be an influence on an exceptional sentence downward. They usually they relate to the crime or the person's criminal history. If you're involved in a bank robbery, but you're not the person who had the gun, or maybe you did some things to help the victims, that might be something you could consider. But whether or not you have health issues, you have kids to support, other kind of personal reasons, I think, are reasons that the state Supreme Court has found not to be sufficient to support an exceptional sentence down. In this case, there are two kind of categories that the judge relied upon. First, the non-statutory reasons that I've mentioned. And then finally, there's the payment of restitution she mentions that Mr. Young made. And I think that the legislature, the way they worded it is they say that before detection, the defendant compensated or made a good faith effort to compensate the victims, and that's not what happened here. This isn't a full Ponzi scheme or a true Ponzi scheme where he's taking money from new investors and using to pay off old ones, but it is sort of like that where he's taking money and a little bit of money and paying the investors, at least those who squawk the loudest, to make them think that they're still invested in something, to keep them from going to the authorities, et cetera.
So is that why you say this payments that have been characterized as restitution are not made in good faith?
Yes, they're not. If you were to accept that argument, a person involved in a classic Ponzi scheme, which is just you collect money and you tell people you're investing it, and as new investors come in, you pay the old investors a little bit, and they all say, gosh, I invested with this guy, and I made $5,000 last month, and now you invest. That guy would be eligible for a first offender waiver if you accept that, because he was paying the victims, and that's what they would characterize as a good faith effort of repayment. I think those words good faith have to mean something. I cite the only authority I have for good faith, which is just Black's Law Dictionary. Maybe there's a case somewhere that discusses it, but I think it has to be someone who expresses remorse, accepts responsibility, and tries their best to make amends before they're detected. I don't think it's someone who says, all right, this victim is really bothering me, I'll pay them some money so that they'll go away, and, you know, that way my scheme will go undetected for some period of time. I think I've, well, exhausted most of my arguments, and you've read them all. But
now, you refresh my memory, because you, I think you were arguing in the brief that the payments were made only after the payments that at least Mr. Young's relying on were made only after the department had begun the investigation. Is that correct?
No, I didn't mean to. I don't think I said that. But what happened was, as the scheme, before it was detected, he was making payments to people. I think he paid about $500,000, $90,000 of which was settlement of a lawsuit. But he made payments to people that were characterized as returns on their investment. He didn't say to them, look, I'm sorry, I spent your money on my winery, here's what I've got, I'm going to give it to you. He said, here's $18,000 in one case, this is return on your investment's still making money and earning returns. That's not the same thing as actually making a good faith effort to repay people out of remorse.
So are we focused on how we interpret that evidence? Because you're characterizing what was done, or does the record more clearly demonstrate his purpose for the payments, in his own words, the transactions?
Well, I think the burden is on the defendant. Person who is seeking an exceptional sentence really has the burden of demonstrating why the record supports the exceptional sentence, to say, here are the reasons why. And the only record we have, the only part of the record we have, which I've cited to, is the certificate of probable cause, which was filed as part of the papers. And if you read the explanations that people made for why they received money, none of them said, Mr. Young came to me remorsefully and said, I'm so sorry, I've spent your money on my winery, you know, I've got some money left over, I'll give it to you. All of them said, without exception, that he told them that their money was, the money he was returning, was returns on their investment, profits, interest, whatever. So I think under those circumstances, they haven't made the requisite showing that the record supports the exceptional sentence either.
All right.
I see, my time's just about up.
Right. Thank you. You have 2 minutes on rebuttal.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Tom McDonough. I represent Mr. Young. We're here to request, urge this court to affirm the sentence of Judge Inveen. Your Honor brought up the statute about good faith, and I'd like to point out the statute is in the alternative. 994A, 535 states, you know, at B, sub B, before detection, the defendant compensated or made a good faith effort to compensate the victim of the criminal conduct for any damage or injury sustained. So it's in the alternative. And the characterization of the compensation, whether it's dividend, return of capital, is not in the statute. It just needs to be compensated, and the record reflects there was compensation.
So you say that essentially the motivation behind the compensation is irrelevant to the sentencing?
Absolutely. We'd be speculating what his state of mind was. I think we're stuck with the findings, which state quite clearly that he did compensate the victims. I think it was $523,000, according to Clerk's Paper 74 on that chart. Prior to the information being filed, he compensated these victims, some of the 16, $523,000, which was netted in the agreed restitution of $1.2 million.
So you would see no distinction between what he owed them under the investment contract and restitution, which is by definition the return of property improperly taken?
Well, it's netted. The investment contract was one amount, and over time he made payments to them, and the restitution amount is net of payments, and I think the statute allows for that, and that's what the findings of Judge Indian.
But don't you have to show that he didn't return to them what he owed them in the course of the contract, but what he wrongfully deprived them of? That would be the restitution amount.
Well, there is some proof of that, and you need to look no further than the verbatim report of the proceedings when some of the victims came forward. Mr. Kenny and Mr. Jackson in particular stated in 2006, Mr. Jackson stated in verbatim report of proceedings at page 14 that he received $345,000 in 2006, and Mr. Kenny acknowledged receiving restitution, that he wanted restitution, and those were some of the things that Judge Inveen wrestled with when coming up with this sentence. So, you know, while counsel focused on the non-statutory factors, and we can't separate the defendant from his medical issues, he's 70 years old now and has a long array of medical conditions, but I want to focus on the statutory mitigating factors, which I think justifies the sentence quite clearly. And as you note from the record, and even more so, among the 8,000 pages of discovery, there was a statement from one of the victims buried in there that restitution will set you free, was a comment from one of these defendants.
But one of the problems with restitution is then we let folks that either have wealth or have earning capacity buy their way out of punishment. And wasn't that the point of the SRA, was to create ranges so the judges weren't saying, you're a nice Caucasian American with a good earning history and you're promising to pay these folks back? You don't go to jail, but this guy can't work, and so he's going to jail?
Well, not unlike our tort law, we kind of take the victim or the defendant as we find him, and this 70-year-old defendant had a proven capacity, track record of earnings, and the ability to earn money, and he demonstrated that in our sentencing memo and a history of paying these victims, and the judge was persuaded that there were substantially compelling reasons to accept that as a statutory mitigating factor, and he has the ability to do it, and the victims wanted restitution, and the judge allowed it, and I don't believe it creates any caste system in any way, shape, or form. He's 70 years old, and he's paying. It's a lifelong sentence. It's $1.2 million. It's a lifelong financial commitment. It's under the abuse of discretion test that under Jeanette and Allert, it's not clearly too lenient. So I think it's the structured discretion that the SRA established, I think Judge Inveen exercised that structured discretion in weighing those things and allowing restitution and setting the restitution at a very high bar that he's going to be faced with for the rest of his life.
What is the nature of his lawful employment now?
His lawful employment, Your Honor, is he's a business consultant. He has some longtime clients. You know, he was a former CPA, but he lost his license He didn't renew it. He doesn't need it for that. He does projections. He'll do analyses for longtime clients, and you know, from the tax returns that are on file, he historically nets on his Schedule C $30,000 to $50,000, and he's, you know, paid up with a clerk of the court. He's been paying about $1,200 a month. He's a couple months ahead, so he's paid $15,600 since July. That's been distributed to these victims, and he's in a position to continue that for the foreseeable future. So with his, you know, long list of, you know, ailments and reasonable living expenses and little thing like legal fees, I mean, he's doing okay for a 70-year-old, in my opinion.
So I wanted to ask you the same question I put to the state in this case. Looking at Pascal and those cases, it seems to me, and I may be oversimplifying this, that the tendency has been we're going to focus on the crime itself in determining what the appropriate sentence is, as opposed to the individual who is found or commits the crime, and that's a policy decision the legislature seems to have made. What I've always wondered is, where is that in the SRA that says that? What's the legislative history, statutory subsection? I mean, the Supreme Court seems to say it in Pascal, but where is that in the law?
I'm unable to point you to one, Your Honor, other than for this particular type of case, my analysis is securities fraud isn't graduated like, you know, first-degree securities fraud, second-degree like robbery or something like that. So my opinion on the restitution is the payment of restitution makes the crime of securities fraud more or less egregious, you know, by the amount of compensation he made to these victims. So it's something that the legislature did not consider. So it's something that can be considered at sentencing as a statutory mitigating factor.
Well, if, regardless of what we can discern from the legislature, if the Supreme Court over this extended period of time has interpreted the law this way, the factors that the trial court relied on here really go to the individual nature of Mr. Young as opposed to the crime itself.
Not the restitution, I submit. That's a statutory mitigating factor. The individual factors come in on the back end when I propose the purpose of the law, particularly 010 sub 6 about making frugal the state's resources. All these medical expenses, the $70,000 a year for his co-pays, deductibles, and his knee replacement, those would be passed on to the Department of Correction. And Judge Inveen was, you know, very mindful of that. And, you know, since he's on his own, his insurance will continue to pay that and has. So that's the purpose, and it's, like I say, it's hard to take the individual characteristic away from the defendant because he's a living, breathing human being. But they are consistent with the purpose of the SRA. I think we get the sentences justified clearly under the mitigating factor for restitution, and then, you know, the purpose of the SRA comes in as, you know, icing on the cake to justify. We clearly a record. I don't think you have to go any further than the findings. I think they're pretty strong findings in the civil arena. You know, I think it wouldn't be very wise for somebody to appeal these findings. They're very, very strong in my view. You need to look no further than those conclusions and the one finding that states, you know, each of the following findings are a basis for an exceptional sentence are sufficient to merit a departure from the sentencing guidelines standing alone or taken together as a whole. And, you know, there's specific findings as to the restitution, the amount that they were paid, $523,000 to the victims prior to filing of the information. That's right in line with the statutes. It's head on as a matter of law that it's sufficient and substantial and compelling by a preponderance of the evidence. The record is clear, and the findings support the record. And under the abuse of discretion standard, I don't think it can be said that Judge Inveen abused her discretion in considering restitution as a mitigating circumstances under these findings and the unique circumstances of this case. So I'm out of time. Thank you for your attention, and please affirm.
Thank you, counsel. And we have 2 minutes for rebuttal.
All right, thank you. Counsel is correct about the way the statute is worded. It does say compensated or made a good faith effort to compensate. This is one of the statutory mitigating factors. But Mr. Young didn't do either of those things. I assume the word compensated would mean that he'd repaid them in full, or they made a good faith effort to do that. And here, you keep in mind that he had $5 million that he'd received from GemStar in his hands. He could have. All of that money should have gone to the investors. They were the ones who put their money at risk, not Mr. Young. But at that point, he had a decision to make. He could have said, I think I'll take $1.2 or $1.7 million of this, and I'll repay them all their 401k money, their home equity money, whatever other money they'd invested in this scheme. And he would still have had over $3 million he could have stolen to use for his winery. But at that moment, he didn't do that. He spent $4.3 million of that money on his winery and didn't compensate anybody. I just wanted to correct one thing. At the time of the sentencing, one of the investors said that he'd received $345,000. That's true. That was for the previous hedge fund investment. It was called Director's Performance Fund. And Mr. Young did repay the principal amount to those investors He did take some of that money, too, for his winery. It's my final thought. I think this is the reason that the legislature enacted the SRA. I mean, look at looking at these kinds of disparities in sentencing from courthouse to courthouse and county to county and even judge to judge, it just seems like at times it's unfair. I mean, in my time doing this, I've been doing these kinds of cases for years. This is the first case I've had where a defendant who's stolen this much money hasn't received at least some prison time or jail time. Here we have a sentence that, in effect, lets him out. He received a first offender waiver and some work release for $1.2 million.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Includes